Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on our very special episode 134, Dr. Mark Kumayan of the University of Southern California joins me to discuss his career and current and future engineering applications to treat retinal diseases such as macular degeneration. Dr. Kumayan's work can be found at his website at the Ginsberg Institute for Biomedical Therapeutics. That's at ibt.usc.edu. Today's shameless plug, we will be conducting a first-ever online content for ophthalmologists marketing and education course at the AAO annual meeting in Chicago. Our course will be Monday at 4:30 p.m. in room N136. I will be on the panel, Drs. Usibomo Abugo, Rahul Khurana, Steve Christensen, and Matthew Weed. We'll cover it all in 1 hour. It's short, but it should be fun and educational. Please come and support us. If any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now privileged to be joined by Dr. Mark Kumayan. Dr. Kumayan is Professor of Ophthalmology and Biomedical Engineering at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, California. He is also the Director of the Ginsberg Institute for Biomedical Therapeutics at USC. Dr. Kumayan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Happy to be part of this interview.
So we start all interviews with new guests, and you're a new guest to the program, with a very simple question that leads to some interesting answers, which is, why did you become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
Well, it started off a while back, as you can imagine, and I was interested in neurosurgery, and at that point, my grandmother started to go blind from complications of diabetic retinopathy. And while I was in medical school, it really made me focus not only in ophthalmology, but in particular retina, and trying to develop therapies and potentially cures and preventative measures for retinal diseases.
And then at what point did you complete your PhD, and how did that factor into, you know, your clinical training at the time?
That is a non-traditional path. So I had already started my residency. Well, I was closer to the end of my medical school when I realized this. So there wasn't enough time to redo a PhD. So I ended up getting my PhD in biomedical engineering. So at the end of the medical school, I took a year off and then also continued during my internship and residency. So there was a lot of overlap, a lot of after-hour work, but I was able to pull it off by doing it almost simultaneously with the internship and residency. But I did need to take a year off between medical school and internship to take some of those courses.
And then in terms of your research interests, so you initially, when you finished your training, you were previously at the Wilmer Eye Institute in Baltimore, correct?
When I finished my fellowship, that's correct. I joined the faculty of the Wilmer Eye Institute.
And then at what point did you decide to make the move to USC? And talk a little bit about changing jobs as an academician and kind of the pros and cons and what you encountered as you moved.
Yeah, I mean, I was at Wilmer Eye Institute for about 5 years, and I'd already been promoted pretty fast track into an associate professor, and I was going to be promoted pretty quickly into a tenured full professor at Johns Hopkins, which is obviously difficult and a major accomplishment. But at that point, I was really at the crossroads in my research. The company that had formed around the technology was based in Southern California, a company called Second Sight. And there was just so much travel back and forth between the East and the West Coast that I ended up considering moving out here. But I didn't know how or where. And that's where, Steve Ryan, who many of us know is really one of the icons and giants in retina, was visiting us on the board of trustees at Johns Hopkins, who convinced me to considering moving out to USC. So I did. And it was really the project that has driven me throughout my life. It was really the project that made me focus in on biomedical engineering. It was really the project that made me move out to USC. And the project, by that I mean the development of the Argus implant.
Let's talk a little bit about the Argus implant. Talk a little bit about the technology and kind of the evolution into the Argus 2, which is now FDA approved, and a little bit about how that working in an academic environment but still having that relationship with industry. Because sometimes navigating that kind of area, the overlap between them can be a little tricky, but you really have done it very successfully with Second Sight, and we'll talk a little bit about your current projects as well.
Yeah, so the Argus implant, which is many people call it the Bionic Eye Project, was really science fiction back when we thought of it. How do you put electronics in and around the eye and have it interface with the otherwise blind retina? And then these implanted electronics wirelessly, talk to a camera and have the images, conveyed that way. So basically, that all aspects of it were pretty difficult. Even back then, tiny cameras were not available. Image processing was difficult, but the telemetry, meaning wireless communication of power and data into the eye, we don't have enough room to put a big battery like pacemakers do. And then, of course, the implantable part, not only implanting the electronics and keeping them working in and around the eye, but also, the delicate electrode interface with the retina without it damaging and tearing the retina. And then, of course, the whole aspect of software development. What kind of signals and codes were these electrodes to provide to the otherwise blind retina? And then what kind of blindness to target? So all that culminated into, targeting inherited retinal degenerations, where the photoreceptors are damaged severely, and patients are now to light perception or worse vision. And then these electrodes sort of stimulate the remaining retinal neurons and send the information via the optic nerve to the brain. And doing this all in real time, capturing the images from the camera and then using these controlled electrical pulses to stimulate the retina. So, that's where the project ended up, but it was very, very challenging all along the way, and it took me, 30 years almost to today. I mean, we started 30 years ago. And I think the major breakthroughs came really when we got short-term tests with handheld electrodes in the operating room, had otherwise blind patients be able to see spots of light, and that gave us enough, proof of science, so to speak, to develop a longer-term implant, which we developed an Argus 1 series, which was basically hijacking a cochlear implant and using those electrodes. But we realized very quickly that 16 electrode and putting the electronics behind the ear and tunneling a cable, underneath the temporalis muscle around the eye and into the eye was very complicated. So it led to the Argus 2, which is basically like, electronics and the antenna sit like a scleral buckle around the eye, and then the electrodes go in via the pars plana and are attached via tiny retinal tack onto the macula. So that's the Argus 2, and now, as you know, it's more than 300 have been implanted in more than 30 countries around the world. So it's really just good to see that eventually take off. And to the point of, whether this could have been done in academia, obviously not, or whether this could have just been done in industry, probably not. You needed the academia to really break, the academic environment to really break the ice, or do the early proof of science projects. High risk industry typically doesn't like to do it. But once you get it to a point where you understand the specs and you kind of understand how to build it, then it's development, and that tends to be done better in a company. So the big R, as I call it, big research part, is, in my opinion and in my experience, is done best in academic settings. The big D, which is the development, is done better in industry. So there was this handoff that needed to happen. And yeah, I mean, a lot of technologies can fall through the crack, don't make it across the chiasm. We call this the valley of death, where early ideas cannot be commercialized. But we made it. We did the handoff and handed it off. But look, I mean, a lot of other ideas people have had, including myself, don't make it across the valley of death for one reason or the other.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you may reference the term bionic eye, and that's a term that's been thrown around the media, and it's really groundbreaking what you guys were able to do in terms of, like you said, over 300 implanted. What do you think about the future of this type of technology, like the electrode type technology versus, you know, other projects you've worked on, including neural sheets or RPE sheets? Do you think there's more of a ceiling on one of these technologies than the other? And ultimately, if we're talking about, for example, you know, end-stage macular degeneration or other sort of blinding conditions that are very prevalent, which one of these do you feel, looking forward, has more viability and is more likely to be what we'll be doing in 25 or 30 years?
Well, one thing before I answer that question is that the electrode technology, now we've advanced it to a product called Orion. Orion is repurposing those electrodes and different type of chip, but that implant goes in the visual cortex. So basically, it addresses the other half of blindness where the optic nerve or the retina is so damaged that we cannot interface the retina with the Argus series. So the Orion series, already five subjects have been implanted, obviously by neurosurgeons, and it's starting to show some very promising results. So the electrodes, you know, we can, in the visual system, we can put them in the retina, we can put them at the visual cortex, and I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that. In terms of, you know, what technology is it? Is it stem cells? Is it, you know, gene therapy? Is it bioelectronics? Is it some sort of new drug therapy? You know, the complicated diseases really require a mixed bag, and really all of these things, I believe, to address them. You know, if you have a sick cardiovascular disease, it ends up requiring many of these things. So I envision that in the future, each one will have its place, you know, in terms of the severity of the disease and the type of disease we're dealing with. So currently, it's really, really hard to make new synapses in neurons. Synaptogenesis is this, you know, is the word. It's very, very difficult to do and have controlled synaptogenesis. So, you know, that is kind of a hindrance a little bit to the stem cell, but, you know, we took a different path and we said that, you know, if we put RPE cells in patients with geographic atrophy, well, was there enough of the outer nuclear layer still preserved where they could grow out outer segments? So this concept of dormant photoreceptor, where if there's no RPE, then, you know, you can't sustain the outer segment, but the inner segment may still sit there dormant. And when you put a new RPE sheet, the outer segment grows from the inner segment. And we're getting some really good results on our phase 1-2A study. We published that on the cover of Science Translational Medicine just earlier this year. So I think, so there's an example, whereas the electronic implants, you know, you don't need to form a synapse. They basically stimulate the remaining cells and effectively work or bypass the damaged cells. So it's just gonna, you know, it's gonna, and gene therapy, I mean, obviously, you know, if you can put genes in to prevent cell loss, or gene therapy to, you know, for example, rhodopsin, channel rhodopsin, to sort of put in light, make cells that are not light sensitive. So I think as we look at this armamentarium or toolkit, we have a number of things in it, and they very well may work, and I believe they will work, you know, differently for different diseases.
You know, you reference again the difference in terms of forming the new synapses versus stimulating the existing cells. And, you know, a question that, and yet, if there's a resident or fellow, someone unfamiliar may ask is, let's say, for example, you have a patient with retinitis pigmentosa, where it's really the photoreceptors that have taken the damage, but in theory, the nerve fiber layer or ganglion cell layer with the cell bodies attached to it is intact. What is there a ceiling on how well you can see by stimulating those cells, or is that simply a matter of the technology? I guess my question is, if someone's been blind for a long period of time, Is there some sort of attrition of those quote-unquote normal cells simply from lack of stimulation? And if so, is that reversible?
Yeah, I mean, your retinal tissue doesn't just sit there dormant. In fact, there is some transsynaptic degeneration of the bipolar cells and the ganglion cells. And also there's, you know, rewiring. So they don't just sit there, but they start to make new and aberrant synapses. So you have to, you know, sort of work with that system, a remodel system, and a system that has decreased number of neurons, and you have to stimulate the remaining cells in a very efficient manner, you know, where the currents don't spread, but they're more localized. So those are all the sort of the challenges of an electrode-based technology. But, you know, we've gotten some very, very good results. Recently, Dr. Yoon in Korea has a patient, for example, that, you know, can see 2,500. So that's a long, long ways from when we started with the Argus One, where we're, you know, 10,000. So the tech, you know, it is moving along through a lot of understanding of how to do current steering and electrical stimulation better. But the question still remains, if we continue to do it better and better, what's the limit? And we haven't hit the limit yet, but it could very well be that the limit is only 2,200, or it could be that the limit is 2,060. I mean, nobody really knows. So we have to keep pushing the envelope. And so far, we haven't hit the limit on what these electrodes can do in terms of visual acuity.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, in addition to all this research, it requires, we talked about the industry support, but it requires running a lab. And in addition to you, there's a whole team, right? There's the team of the fellows, postdocs, clinicians, such as Dr. Amir Kashani, who's your colleague, who's working with you on the RPE sheets. And there's mentorship involved in this from your end, because now you're kind of the one who rides the ship. Talk about a little bit about your role as a mentor, as a researcher. And so if we have, you know, potential clinician scientists who are listening, or maybe even ophthalmologists who aren't clinician scientists who may be involved in clinical translational research with their colleagues in the future, what sort of advice would you offer now to someone who's coming up, or someone who is just at the beginning of their career, or one of your own mentors in your lab, in terms of general principles scientifically, and then specifically looking at retina in particular going forward in the future?
I think there's, you know, people are, most of us are naturally drawn to asking the question why, and we're very interested in helping our patients, and so most of us are that way, almost naturally, and some of us also really like, you know, the concept of having a patent or an idea, but really that's just the beginning. And I think to materialize that, first and foremost, you know, you need time. And the one thing we all don't have, and it becomes scarcer and scarcer with all the electronics and us being accessible all the time, is literally time. So you have to carve out the time and make a commitment to doing this type of work. Whether you are working with a large team and you're the clinical advisor, or whether you're heading up an institute like I am, those are two in opposite spectrums, opposite aspects of the spectrum, but you still need time. So if, you know, time, to carve out time is very important. We have lots of pressures on our time. So first and foremost, time, make the time to do it if you're interested. Otherwise, you're just gonna be a lot of people who are unhappy, your colleagues, et cetera, and obviously yourself as well. Secondly, you know, it's just that these things can take a long time. I already mentioned how long this took, and sometimes they don't, but most of the time they do, because we're venturing into areas that we don't fully understand, if barely understand. So you know, you have to have the concept and the long-term view of it, that it's going to take some time. And third is, you know, there's going to be lots of failures along the way, and you just have to bounce back and believe in your ideas, and there's going to be a lot of naysayers along the way. And perhaps last, but certainly not least, you have to secure the funding to do it, because if you run out or you can't get funding, then obviously things won't go anywhere. So it's just really in that order, a real dedication of time, having the long-term view, not letting, you know, things set you back, and then making sure, just being practical, that you can monetize what you're thinking of. I mean, if you're thinking of, you know, $1 billion project, well, it's going to be hard to monetize it. But so you have to just really be pretty practical about it. And you know, of course, it goes without saying that you have to work on an important unmet medical need, an important problem in blindness and retinal disease. So that's sort of my 2 cents worth, you know, for whatever that is worth. But each one of us sort of finds their way to solve this problem if we're interested. And I think that everybody can contribute, whether you're, I mean, I had these, many of these ideas when I was obviously a resident. So if you have ideas as a resident or fellow, early faculty, private practice, academia, you can always make it work if there's a will.
That's great advice. Last thing, I'll just let you comment quickly. You reference, you know, something that will make an impact, or something that's an unmet need, and your lab is trying to address a specific unmet need. In terms of other unmet needs, what do you think is the biggest unmet need in retina besides what your lab is studying?
Well, I think the, you know, there are many, a lot of our conditions, even with the great anti-VEGF drugs we have, we still, you know, need many patients who don't improve 3 lines of vision or don't improve, and then they get, you know, worse over a period of time. So it's great to have these anti-VEGF drugs, because before that it was really very dismal, the outcomes with some of these diseases. But now that we do have them, we still, you know, are leaving a lot of vision on the table, you know, either because compliance or people can't get drugs, or, you know, that these drugs just simply don't work because the disease is more advanced, or they just don't work. So in some diseases, so I think, you know, as you look at it, we have to address the unmet need in that regard of all these patients who have lost the vision. So, I mean, pick any condition. I don't want to pick one versus the other, but obviously, each one of these, I mean, macular degeneration, especially a non-neovascular dry macular degeneration with large geographic atrophy areas, is especially an area which currently doesn't have a treatment. And, you know, there are a lot of companies working, and, you know, including our stem cell effort. There is, you know, there's very interesting ways to look at artificial intelligence and use AI to have some predictive nomograms, or perhaps help screen. There's, you know, home health screening and mobile screening type of approaches that are more on the preventative side. So those are all very, very exciting areas. Gene therapy, already mentioned, whether it's replacing a defective gene, or whether it's you know, introducing a gene to produce, for example, anti-VEGF. So whether it's introducing a gene to make a cell that's otherwise not light sensitive, and a cadre of new drugs that could work in combination. And then there's obviously surgical instrumentation. We haven't talked much about, we talked about implants, but there's a lot of room to improve surgical instrumentation. And we've seen some of the heads up display with True Vision type of headsets that Alcon is promoting, but they're intraoperative OCTs. But there is a number of things we could also do much better intraoperatively in terms of surgical instrumentation, in addition to, you know, the implants that we talked about. So I really see, you know, a lot of opportunity. I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. Some of us, you know, in who've been in it long enough feel like, wow, everything has been done or invented. But I don't look at it that way. I think a lot is yet to come, and it's just really exciting to be in retina. We just have to find the time of the best minds to focus in and innovate in these areas with others.
Dr. Mine, thanks so much for your time and for joining us, and I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it. We're going to put a link up to the Ginsberg Institute, and more information on each of the technologies we talked about will be listed on that website, and the link will be included with the podcast episode. So thank you again, and you have a great day.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 134 episodes, including this one, can be found in there sorted by category, in addition to our blog. There are links to sign up for our mailing list to get updates on each episode as they come out. There are links to subscribe to the iTunes Store for your mobile device. You can also like our Facebook page or find us on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. To contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love feedback. Feedback gives us episode ideas such as this one, so please continue to send in ideas. And we love both positive reviews on the iTunes Store and Google Play, as well as feedback to us directly so we know what to do better in the future. Many thanks to Dr. Humayun for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Vinicasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.